Court landed on his back on the wooden slats, he grabbed the executioner's rifle with both hands and yanked hard across his body, tipping the executioner over his body because he was caught by the sling around his neck. The two guards splashed into the water as one, and just as the executioner shouted, he too fell face first into the lake. Court rolled off the dock to his right, following the executioner off the boards. He crashed into and then disappeared under the blood-red surface of the water. Bassett had heard the gunshot, then the splash, and he knew it was his time to die. Then, he heard the shouting, and the second splash. He looked up, his eyes focused on the end of the dock, just when the American rolled from his back off the pier, fell 1 meter down, and belly-flopped into the water. Around him, the ISIS fighters began spinning towards the dock, their guns rising in front of them. Bassett had two guards just behind him. They were taking him to die next, after all. And now they opened fire on the lake at the edge of the pier. Both weapons were extended over Bassett's kneeling form, so he stood up between the guns, leapt back, and yanked other men tied to him as he went. The two ISIS gunmen fell to the ground under the scrum of prisoners, and the prisoners kicked and bit and elbowed and shouted as they fought with them. Other men on the rope line fell back or jumped back, knocking into gunmen standing close to them. Underwater, Court grabbed at the eyes of the executioner with one hand while he pulled the AK with the other hand. The water was 15 feet deep here, dark and brown, so Court felt his way forward, vying for the rifle before the man recovered and thought to reach for one of the ornamental knives in his belt. It was clear the executioner did not swim. The panic in his actions had nothing to do with the fact that he was in a life-and-death struggle with another human, and everything to do with the fact he was underwater and unable to breathe. Court pulled the weapon away as the executioner reached out for it, and the American spun the barrel towards the thick man, pounded the muzzle into the man's solar plexus because he couldn't see him and needed to be sure of his target, and pulled the trigger at contact distance. The weapon fired. The bullet slammed into the man's chest and blew out his back. Court's feet hit the lake bed now, and he shoved off with them, launching back up towards the surface. His head broke the water, and he sucked in a huge breath of air, but instantly he saw he was 10 feet from the edge of the pier, and at least four men were running up it now, heading in his direction. The fighter in front opened fire, raking the water around Court with brass-jacketed lead. Court dove again, kicked his legs, and shot under the pier. Here, he spun onto his back, while still below the surface, and he reached up with his AK. He kicked along, a backstroke without the arm movements, and he opened fire on the wooden dock right above him, sending dozens of rounds up, splintering slats, tearing through the legs and torsos of the men running down to the edge of the pier. A man fell off into the water on the left, and Court tossed the empty AK in his hands and swam after the rifle that had been held by his newest victim. Bassett slammed his head back twice into the nose of an ISIS fighter lying under him on the lakeshore, and when he was certain the man was dazed from the pounding, he drew a knife from the man's belt. He cut his bindings free in seconds, although he also sliced into his own hand doing so, and then he grabbed the man's rifle and eviscerated him with a long burst of fire to his abdomen. Up the row of prisoners, an ISIS gunman shot two Kurds at close range and was aiming at a third, but Bassett shot him twice in the pelvis, dropping him where he stood. The prisoners alive near the wounded man fell onto him, tearing at clothing and flesh with their hands. One man got the AK off the doomed terrorist, while others in the line began untying one another's bindings by picking at the knots with their fingertips. Bassett and a prisoner nearby both had weapons now, and they poured fire into the ISIS gunmen near the Ural truck, as well as those fighting amid the line of prisoners. The ISIS fighters fired back, of course, and soon the man next to Bassett went down with a cry of pain. Bassett emptied his weapon and lunged for the gun dropped by the fallen prisoner. He got his hands on it and spun around, but saw two gunmen aiming at him from higher on the hill. He knew he didn't have time to get off any shots before they gunned him down. Gunfire cracked from behind, and both men launched backwards onto the rocky hillside. Bassett looked over his shoulder and saw the American, 50 feet from the shoreline in the bloody water, firing his Kalashnikov, using a floating body to rest the weapon on. Bassett spun back to the ISIS men scrambling around the hillside, and he fired, and by now two more prisoners had taken weapons and were in the fight. Court staggered out of the water when the crazed shootout was over, then fell into the salty mud. Bassett limped over, holding on to his own right forearm with his bloody hand. The young Syrian had been shot in the arm and the foot, and he also bled from where he'd cut himself. But he ignored his injuries, dropped to his knees next to the American, and put his hand on the man's back.
"My friend, we did it! You did it! But more Daesh will surely come. We have to go."
Court looked up at him, coughed lake water, and vomited into the dirt.
How many did we lose?
Bassett helped Court to his feet.
"I don't know. Many. But many more of us are left. We will take the truck and go."
"Go where?"
Court asked. He barely had the energy to stand.
"Anywhere,"
Bassett said with a wide smile.
"I like this plan,"
Court said, and then he dropped face first into the mud. Bassett called some men over to help move the American to the truck. Chapter 79. Captain Robert Anderson sat in the main cabin of the UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter as it streaked impossibly low over the dark desert landscape, and he steeled his stomach to what was about to come. Over the cabin intercom, he'd been notified by the pilot that they were moments from hitting the hills, and when that happened, this low and fast flying was going to make life difficult for him and the 8 other men here in the back of the helo. Of course, he knew the computers on board kept the machine from slamming into terrain, but he also knew that every time he flew nap of the earth, he got nauseous. He almost never puked, but he always felt like he was going to puke. Just as he told himself to put the motion of the helo out of his mind, his headset came alive again.
"Captain, we got a frago coming in from the JOC.
A frago was a fragmented order, meaning an addendum to an operations order in place. Their current order was to leave Syria, to head north straight up towards the Turkish border as fast as possible, and Anderson hadn't expected any fragos to interfere or delay this order, because his Joint Operations Center had seemed very insistent he carry it out as soon as possible. Anderson said,
"Roger, send frago."
The captain listened to the transmission for over a minute, then made some notes on a pad he kept in his load-bearing vest. A smile grew on his face.
"Copy. Zulu out."
Seconds later, the UH-60 banked to the northwest, picked up even more speed, and entered the hills. It lurched upwards to miss a steep rise, and Robbie Anderson immediately regretted eating the 2 candy bars he'd downed not 20 minutes earlier. A half hour after receiving his frago, Anderson and the rest of his 12-man A-team leapt out of their 2 helos in a rugged mountainous area to the northeast of Palmyra. He knew they couldn't remain on the ground for any time at all without endangering his men and his helicopters. Fortunately, he had no plans to hang out here for the rest of the evening. With his weapon on his shoulder, he and his team pushed forward into a walled structure where they found a large Russian Ural truck parked alone. The men cleared the area, making sure there were no hostiles, and then Anderson climbed into the bed of the vehicle. He found a man sitting Indian style, his hands in the air, and another lying on his back, with his face partially bandaged. Anderson illuminated him with the flashlight on his rifle and confirmed he had the 2 he was looking for.
ID confirmed. I need 2 up here to help me move them.
The 2 men were carried off the truck and into the back of the helo less than 3 minutes after landing. The helicopter rose into the air, then returned to its stomach-wrenching nap of the earth flying to the north. Inside the Black Hawk, the new passenger prone on the deck lay still until a green beret medic held smelling salts under his nose. The man lurched a little and opened his eyes. Captain Anderson knelt down over him.
"Sir, sir, can you hear me?"
The American Anderson only knew as Slick seemed to come to his senses quickly.
"Oh, hey, Robbie. What's going on?"
"You know, not much, the usual."
The man smiled a little and looked around.
"Yeah.
You've lost some blood, and you're probably dehydrated. We'll fix you up."
"Thanks."
Robbie nodded.
"Had a rough couple of days, I see."
"The usual." "Where's Bassett?"
Bassett waved from the other side of the helo when the American looked his way. A medic was tending to his bloody forearm, hand, and foot. Robbie said,
"He called my command about 45 minutes ago and gave us your coordinates. We just happened to be passing through, so we swung by to pick you up."
"Passing through?"
"Yep. We're exfilling Syria. getting the hell out before anyone knows we were here. I thought you said you'd be here a couple more months.
Yeah. Well, that was before.
Before what?
Sir, if you don't know, then you're pretty much the only man on Earth that doesn't.
Court thought he understood.
He's dead. Azam's dead.
A slow smile grew on Anderson's face.
Ahmed Azam is dead as dirt. State TV confirmed it this afternoon. Killed by terrorists while personally leading the fight on the front lines of Palmyra.
The American nodded.
Yeah, that's exactly what went down.
Robbie turned somber now.
Yusuf and Khalid didn't make it.
Court nodded.
They are heroes of their nation. No doubt about it.
Robbie looked into the night for a moment. The man said,
Someone gave you the okay to come get me?
Affirm. I've got orders to get you to Incirlik, Turkey. After that, you can do whatever you want.
He smiled.
I suggest a vacation. You won't believe this, but this was my vacation, Captain.
Robbie looked at him like he was insane, then handed him a bottle of water.
Court said, You got a sat phone?
Robbie moved to the bulkhead and took a phone out of his backpack. He handed it to the man on the gurney. Court dialed a number, then looked at Robbie, who took the hint and moved away. After several seconds, the line went live.
Hello?
Court put a finger in his left ear and held the phone hard to his right.
It's me.
Vincent Voland did not hide his shock at hearing the American's voice.
Mon Dieu, you are alive!
Tell me about Jamal and Yasmin.
They are in Jordan with me, and they are safe.
Court blew out a long sigh of relief. Voland said,
You did it, didn't you?
You mean Azam? No, I didn't. But apparently it got done.
Right,
Voland said incredulously. Clearly he believed the gray man had assassinated the Syrian president, but he didn't press. Instead, he said,
I have someone else here who wants to say hello, but first, I need you to believe me.
About what?
I gave you some bad information when we last spoke, but I was acting on the best intelligence I had at the time.
What are you talking about?
The phone was silent for several seconds, and then Court heard a woman's voice.
Monsieur, this is Bianca. I want to thank you for everything you have done for my son.
Court couldn't believe it.
You're alive?
Yes, I am. Jamal is, and Yasmin is as well. All thanks to you and Monsieur Voland.
Court just laid his head back onto the gurney and stared at the ceiling of the Black Hawk's cabin.
Well, I'll be damned.
Epilogue. It was a nice summer evening for Sebastian Drexler at the chateau in Lauterbrunnen, Switzerland. He sat on the deck and looked out at the stars, watched deer and rabbit run across the hectares of private land, and enjoyed a Cheval Blanc Bordeaux from 1970. Things were nice, but they weren't perfect. This wasn't his chateau. It belonged to Meyer Privatbank. But he was living here now. For the past month, he had been in charge of the protection detail watching a client of the bank, a woman with a Swiss passport that claimed her name was Ara Karimi, and she was a refugee from the Syrian war. No, things weren't perfect at all. Ara Karimi was in truth Shakira Azam. The woman had arrived in country on a private jet with her children right after the death of the president of Syria, and, through special circumstances arranged by the bank, she had not had to appear in person at any consulate or embassy to obtain her documentation. She'd just flown into the country, gotten a few stamps on her visa and passport from an immigration official who was a friend of Meyer, and then she'd come here. Drexler had been on the same flight from Syria, and although she had been the last person in the world he'd wanted to see before he was put on board the ship in Greece, once he got to Syria and found out Azam was dead, she became his ticket home to Switzerland. Her life was in danger during the tumultuous days after Ahmed's death, and she was one of Meyer Privatbank's most important clients. They wanted her safe from harm, and Drexler was uniquely positioned to make that happen. Accidentally so, but he was there nevertheless. He'd gotten the family out in an SAA plane to Lebanon, and from there they used the Swiss documents to make it into Europe. The kids had immediately been relocated away from the mother, for everyone's benefit. The two daughters were given new identities and sent to boarding school in Luzon. And now, Drexler was back home in Lauterbrunnen, which was good for him. But far from perfect. Shakira sat in front of him now on the deck, the bottle of wine between them. She was carrying on about her plan to retake the reins of leadership in Damascus. As he looked at her, regarded her new short black hairdo, the Botox she'd gotten in Bern that puffed out her lips and fattened her eyelids, and the tanning she'd done to turn her skin several shades darker. He had to admit she looked different, but to him, she was still the same Shakira. Drexler nodded along, engaging in her power fantasy just to keep her happy, because keeping her alive and happy was his job. He felt confident in his skills to accomplish the former, less so the latter. Drexler had been ordered by the bank to protect Shakira for the first few months of her exile. To this end, he had a dozen men on the property at any one time, and he had every manner of alarm and sensor known to man. He did not, however, have fighter planes in the sky, so there was no one to prevent a skydiver from stepping off a limestone cliff thousands of feet above the U-shaped valley where Lauterbrunnen sat, dressed head to toe in black, and then hey-ho jumping, steering his parachute precisely so that he came down silently on the back deck of the chateau, not 10 meters from where Sebastian and Shakira sat with their wine, plotting her return to power. A pair of security men stood in the attached living room, and they saw a billowing black chute as it appeared over the man as he landed behind Drexler, and they pulled firearms and moved towards the windows, but the man under the collapsing canopy saw the men, and he was faster and more sure of his mission than they. He shot them both with a silenced Ruger Mark II integrally suppressed pistol, 3 times each in the chest and throat. Both men died before they fired a round, and the gun that killed them was no louder than an electric typewriter clicking out a few letters. Shakira and Drexler both stood and faced the man who expertly dropped his chute with one hand on his quick release, while holding his pistol on them with the other. "Don't make a sound," the man said, and Drexler remembered the voice. "You?" There was marvel in his tone. "Me," the man said, executing a magazine change of the Ruger so fast, Drexler had not even been able to take advantage of it.
"What do you want?"
Shakira asked. She didn't know who this was. The man said,
"The kids, are they here?"
Neither she nor the Swiss man standing next to her answered the question. Drexler said,
"You are the gray man. You're quite famous. And you are Sebastian Drexler. You're quite an asshole."
Court held his pistol on the woman, and although she didn't look much like the photos he'd seen of Shakira al-Azam, he knew it had to be her. Drexler said,
"You decapitated the Syrian government. But there's a new ruler. He's an Alawi. He's Ba'ath Party. And he says he will continue the war. What the fuck do you think you've accomplished?"
Court said, "Ask Ahmed. Ask Shakira." A pause.
"Go ahead, ask her. I'll wait."
Drexler looked to Shakira and then back to Court. Court said,
"Yeah, I know it's her. You can't go posing for Vanity Fair and then try to hide your identity."
Court scanned the living room, made sure no one was there. He said,
"Yeah, I didn't bring peace, love, and understanding to Syria overnight, and that sucks. But the new guy in charge knows the old guy in charge got fragged for being an asshole. It might not make much difference, but the status quo in Syria wasn't exactly working for anyone. Maybe I didn't end the war, but I helped kill Ahmed, I pissed off the Russians and Iranians, and I killed a bunch of jihadis. I chalked this up in the win column, even before today."
"What's today?"
Shakira asked.
"Today is when I kill Sebastian Drexler and Shakira Azam."
Drexler cleared his throat, flashed his eyes into the living room. It was empty still.
"Was this all for money? Or have you bought into the lies of the West?"
Court said.
"500,000 dead, millions injured, millions displaced. Those lies?"
"All lies,"
Shakira said, and Court could hear the cracking of terror in her voice now. Drexler said,
"You've won, Gray Man. You've already won. Why not take your victory along with the spoils?"
"Meaning?"
Drexler said. Listen, man. My bank can provide you with... Court fired once. The .22 caliber round slammed into Drexler's right knee, dropping him to the deck floor. He grabbed at the wound in pain. Court said, I promised Voland that I'd make it hurt. I'll give you a few seconds' agony, then end it for you.
Fuck you!
Drexler cried out as blood appeared between the fingers clutching his knee. Court pointed the gun at Shakira now, and although she did not move a muscle, he could see her face redden several shades as the panic began to well in her. She said,
Sir, I could make you a very rich man.
Did money buy you happiness?
It helped a great deal.
At the end of the day, you'd have been better off poor back in the UK. The world would have been better off as well. She saw the bribery wasn't working, so she said,
As you know, I have children, 2 daughters. I am all they have left.
The man with the pistol held it steady. There was a version of me who would have cared. I don't really know where that guy went, but he's gone now.
Let me show you photos of them. They are wonderful.
They'll have money and whatever security that it will buy. And they'll probably have some sense that a great wrong was done to them. I hope they channel that rage into something productive, but I can't help them. I can only exact revenge for all those who are dead because of you. Her voice grew with each word as she tried to alert security men to the danger.
Revenge? Revenge? Is revenge really worth any...
Court shot Shakira Azam through the heart. She fell back and landed next to but facing away from Sebastian Drexler, and their blood pooled together. He shot her still body twice more. Court said,
It's not worth much, no. But it's worth more than you.
He started to shift back to Drexler, who had not moved and seemed resigned to his fate. But the door into the living room opened 50 feet away. A man saw Court standing on the deck and pulled his weapon. Court shifted to him to fire, and as he did so, Drexler leapt up on his good leg and dove over the top of the deck railing. It was 2 stories straight down to a steep hillside below. Court shot the guard, but another came behind him a moment later. Court himself rolled onto and over the railing, scaled quickly off the other side, but stopped on a lower balcony. Here, he ran to the northern side of the balcony, out of sight from where he'd climbed from above, and climbed down from there. Court had to drop the last several feet, and he landed in a roll, blunting the impact of the drop. He began sprinting away, pulling a pair of night vision goggles from a dump pouch on his hip as he ran. He knew Drexler could not have gone far, even if he survived the fall, but where Drexler went over would be full of security men in moments, so Court ran off in the other direction. 20 minutes later, he stood in the dark on Schlittwaldstrasse, and a black BMW coupe pulled up next to him. Court climbed in, and the vehicle began moving again. The man behind the wheel said nothing at first, and Court appreciated that, but he knew it wouldn't last. Finally, Vincent Volin turned to him.
So, it's done?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Shakira's done. Drexler got the pain you wanted him to feel, maybe more. But I don't know.
Court turned to the Frenchman.
I'd be locking my doors if I were you.
Melt.
Shit.
Did he say anything? What about her? Did she speak? Tell me, what did they say?
Court said, I don't remember really. Don't shoot, probably. That's usually what you hear. Trust me, you rarely get anything too profound.
Voland was clearly frustrated.
I see.
It was silent between the two men as they drove along the narrow valley road.
Listen, I have been asked to reach out to you by members of the French government, who would like to pay you for everything you have-
Don't insult me, Vincent.
No insult intended. They want to hire you again. They have more work, and you are the only man they will trust with it. It's a show of good faith, nothing more.
Court shook his head. When I get out of this car at the train station, you'll never see me again.
He turned to the older Frenchman.
And if you do, it's only because I've been sent.
Voland turned to the American.
You'd kill me if you were paid to do so.
If you hadn't gotten the kid and Yasmin out of Syria, I would have killed you for free.
but you came through. And you linked Drexler to the bank and found him and Shakira here. You served your purpose. Cort drew his pistol from the small of his back, and Volin turned to look at it, just like I've served mine. Cort tossed the weapon into a backpack in the back of the BMW, then pulled a small Smith & Wesson revolver in a holster from the bag and strapped it to his ankle. The rest of the drive was quiet. Cort climbed out of the BMW at the station, gave Voland a half nod, and began walking inside. As he entered, he pulled out his phone and dialed a number. He made it all the way to the train timetable in the main hall before the call was answered.
Suzanne Brewer.
Cort paused a moment. He knew once he spoke, he was committed. Brewer? There was obvious annoyance in her voice. Cort waited another second as he fantasized about hanging up. But then he spoke. It's Violator. I'm reporting in. You need me? The woman at CIA did not hesitate.
I'm afraid we do.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Agent in Place. Written by Mark Graney. Performed by Jay Snyder. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Copyright 2018 by Mark Strode Graney. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.